Welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast with Bryson, an ongoing cross-discipline dialogue of all things somatics.
Hello, welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast. I'm Bryson Newell, your host. On today's show, I had the pleasure to sit down with Esther Gokhale. Esther studied biochemistry at Harvard and Princeton University and later acupuncture at the San Francisco School of Oriental Medicine. After a crippling back pain during her first pregnancy and an unsuccessful back surgery, she began her lifelong crusade to find a solution to back pain. Her studies at the Aplomb Institute in Paris and years of research in the Burkina Faso, India, and Portugal, and elsewhere led her to develop the Gokhale Method. You can find out more about her and her programs at gokhalemethod.com, and I will leave links to that in the show notes. All right, and before we begin the show, once again, I'd just like to ask listeners to please consider going to our webpage, somaticprimer.com, and donating to the show. Anything is greatly appreciated. Okay, and without further ado, my interview with Esther Gokhale. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
I've known about you for a long time because I was always, I have a martial arts background in Tai Chi. Qigong, and we see in the text all the time the natural anatomy, the natural body, assume a natural posture. And what happened to me is I fell down the rabbit hole realizing, well, what does that mean? There's a very different understanding where they're coming from versus a modern Westerner of how our anatomy is supposed to function, what posture means. And so I came on your work. I heard you on NPR.
Yeah.
So I wanted maybe if you could introduce yourself and tell us what it is you do, how you found this or made these discoveries.
So my name's Esther Gokhale, and when I was 27 and pregnant with my first child, I had a very horrible back problem. Turned out to be a severely herniated L5 S1 disc. And I suffered greatly. I couldn't really carry things. At first, people told me, well, maybe the baby's sitting on a nerve root and it'll be fine after the baby's delivered. It wasn't. It got worse and worse and worse. And I was doing all the usual things, the conventional things, as well as the alternative things. So you name it, I tried it, from physical therapy to chiropractic, acupuncture, acupressure, me checking my head, stretching, strengthening, yoga, massage. And I wasn't getting anywhere. And I ended up having surgery, a laminectomy discectomy at the L5 S1 disc, and followed all the instructions on exercises to do and strengthening to take care of. And then a year later, I re-herniated the same disc and they were offering me another surgery. And this is not looking good. When in your mid-20s, you're looking at multiple surgeries, and I was also advised not to have any more children since I had a weak back and so on. And I didn't need to be told that because, you know, I didn't want to have a repeat of the horrors I had experienced. You know, not only could I not lift my child, I couldn't even lift a cooking pot. And I also couldn't sleep through the night. Like every 2 hours, I'd wake up with muscle spasm. And I didn't want to take pain meds because I was nursing my child. So I ended up just walking around the block until the muscle spasm would ease. And then I would get another couple of hours of sleep. So not healthy, not livable. And then when I had a repeat occurrence, I just ended up casting an ever wider net on what might help my problem, because it just didn't make sense that in my mid-20s, I would be so woefully falling apart as to not be able to really have a normal life. And I'd been very healthy. And musculoskeletally, to all appearances, very healthy as well. I was a yoga model in Bombay and I had been an athlete of various kinds at a kid level, but that was very, and not never really had any medical conditions. So it was a shock to my system to find myself so compromised, so debilitated, and looking at a very different future. So I'd grown up in India. My mother is Dutch. My father is Indian. And my mother was an Indophile and had made a habit of taking us to culturally rich places and expose us to remarkable things and also point out remarkable things in our everyday surroundings. Growing, you know, it was four children growing up in India. And she would point out that the sweeper was amazing, you know, and that she could be on her haunches and spend a couple of hours cleaning our place and never complain and have any problems from that. And that the street vendors could carry these huge amounts of stuff on their head and be very healthy and functional. And she also would make note of their teeth, which were like piano keyboards, and she would comb Bombay high and low for red rice and, you know, unpolished millet and all kinds of things that we as kids were then offered, you know, as part of our wellness health regimen. And so all these things lodged in my brain someplace. So when I got into trouble, the approaches that resonated for me were the approaches that are similarly based on observation of functional people, or, you know, have articulated what highly functional populations are doing differently than what modern people are doing. So, you know, there have been several people over the years who have made note of you know, what Aborigines are doing differently and what different tribal and indigenous people are doing differently. And so those are the ones that drew me. And I believe you have studied Alexander techniques. So, and you teach it, or you have incorporated some ideas from it. I'm not sure. So, so Alexander was one of those people, and Feldenkrais has, you know, and Noel Perez, French yoga teacher who studied with Iyengar, did a lot of pioneering work in this field. And so that really resonated with my memories from growing up in India and seeing these kinds of people be highly functional, be able to do all sorts of things. So that's what I explored. And luckily so, because it's the only direction that gave me any sustained benefit. And so I slowly and surely did better with my back. I was able to refuse the second surgery. And slowly, over a rather extended period, reduce my sciatic pain and learn different ways. And there's a 5-year gap between my first and second children on account of me needing that time to learn how to be in my own body and to gain confidence in my body. And that's when I had child number 2 and 3. And then that was without any pain or incidents whatsoever. You know, I learned cross-country skiing with my son on my back. And I was already a practicing acupuncturist. So I was seeing people for back pain and many other musculoskeletal problems. And I could slowly introduce the things I was learning to them as I was doing that to myself. And then over the years, what I discovered was increasingly efficient and effective ways to teach, to sequence things, to metaphors that land particularly well And it's this mix of languaging and sequencing and using images and using ideas. But my background was very intellectual, Harvard, Princeton, biochemistry. And so I all have always responded well to scientific method and logic. And so I also studied the medical literature and sort of pieced together these different ways, these traditional ways and empirical observations and medical findings to concoct something that would be efficient and effective. Those are the, and safe. Those were my guiding principles. So we've really honed things over time.
That's wonderful. That's a whole lot. Let's try to unpack some of that. So you, after your back pain, you didn't want to get the second surgery. Were you, I don't think you were in India anymore. So you, were you there? These were memories or what did you do? Like, cause then your book.
I was in this country. I had come to this in the US okay. as an exchange student in high school. And then I went, I was a freshman at Harvard, and then I finished college at Princeton. I my major was biochemistry. And so the horrible back incident, you know, when I was pregnant and so on, came after college and after Chinese medicine school. So it was right at the end of becoming an acupuncturist that this came on my path. So I had been here for a long time. So it was memories from my childhood. You know, it gives you a mindset. You know, when you've grown up in India and you've seen people function really well, you believe that, you know, then you know that's possible. And when your own body is not working well, it leads to a different trajectory than if you buy into modern medicine's claim, for example, that we haven't evolved to be upright and that pain is normal and some arthritic changes and degeneration in the discs are normal. You know, we're told a lot of things are normal, a lot of pathology is normal. And so we lower our expectations. But I think my childhood in India helped me see that that doesn't really make sense. That, you know, we've been upright for 6.5 million years. Even by evolutionary standards, that is a long time. And I think we've had plenty of time to adapt to being upright. Entire populations are doing just fine upright. And so these kind of apologies for why we're falling apart don't really make sense.
Yeah. So you mentioned Feldenkrais. Do you know one of his colleagues or the guy that brought him to America, Thomas Hanna? Are you familiar with Thomas Hanna?
Yes, I was actually invited to present at a continuing ed weekend for the Hanna somatic practitioners somewhere in California. And that was really enjoyable because they have really explored this juncture between physical and emotional, which is a direction that I'm very interested in currently.
Yeah. 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 Yes, and he came up with the red light, green light postures, or the lordotic curve and the kyphotic curve. But he also talks a lot about the environment, how our environment's making us sick, and we have to overcome the environment. So, like these people in India, you're talking about are squatting and living more in these traditional lifestyles where we're sitting in desks all the time. So it strikes me that you came to America and you're studying. And then you get this back pain. Is there, like, did you ever get to the root of why this happened? Is there a correlation?
So, you know, when I was growing up in Bombay, I was sitting at a desk as much as I was in college and in this country. You know, most of the Indians you meet in this country will have grown up in an upper middle class kind of context. And so the Indian cities are not exempt from these modern afflictions.
Right.
Yeah. So that's one thing. Another thing is, I don't really blame sitting at a desk or otherwise for our maladies. I think, there are cultures that are more furniture sitting or chair sitting cultures because they're cold. You don't sit on the ground in a place like China or a northern clime. It's like, oh, going back a very long time, people have sat on furniture. And I don't think that that per se is the problem. And I don't believe that modern people should be going back to squatting and sitting on the floor and stuff. It actually doesn't work. And I can explain my ideas around why that is. But I think it's about how you sit, not whether you sit on the floor or squat or on a chair. It's how you sit on that chair. It's perfectly possible to sit well on a chair. And in fact, most modern people cannot sit well squatting or on the floor, in my view, because they didn't grow up doing that. And there's some anatomic things that settle in early life, the ossification of your major joints in the lower body, for example, the ankles, the knees, the hips, it's all cartilage when you're born. And depending on what you're doing in the period that those plates of cartilage get ossified, it's going to either allow you to do certain positions or not. And then you don't get to edit that later on as an adult. That's my view.
Oh, okay. So fine. I think I agree with you. What I mean by Thomas Hanna is saying that, so sitting's part of it, but it's a larger sedentary thing because we're so sedentary and we become disembodied. And so like what you're saying kind of checks, it means like we're sitting in chair, but not sitting well. So sitting well would require some sort of conscious effort and know-how. Is that is
Know-how, especially. Actually, it's very little effort. Once you know how to position your pelvis well, being upright is perfectly possible in a relaxed way. So it's know-how more than anything. And that know-how is usually kinesthetically obtained, in a traditional culture, like the way you're carried as a baby, the way you're modeled by the grown-ups around is how you learn to bend, sit, walk, stand, etc. Yeah, there's a look and a feel. And we're monkey see, monkey do kind of creatures. And so if we're surrounded by good examples, that's one of the ways we can learn. If we're handled well, that's another way we can learn, handled as babies and sat and carried and stretched and so on. The way our furniture is designed is another way we learn either good or poor habits. So there's a lot to be gleaned from the culture, and modern culture really has forgotten which way is up. And so once you've lost your cultural thread, this kinesthetic thread of wisdom, then you're subject to things like fashion and notions about how you should be. Someone makes a compelling argument about you should tuck your pelvis or you should thrust out your chest and chin up, chest out. That's what you're going to do. So, yeah, I do think that I agree with Hannah that your surroundings have a big impact. And I think the differentiation I would make more than any is industrialization versus non-industrial cultures. Because in industrial cultures, you have a kind of separation from family life, and you are pulled in as a cog in a wheel in the machine, kind of big assembly line, or you're sitting behind a computer for many, many hours, and there's nothing to punctuate your day because traditionally it turns out people sit as much as they do in modern times in traditional cultures. So they put sensors on this tribe in East Africa and discovered that they sit 9 hours a day just like we do. But number one, they sit well. Number two, they punctuate their sitting with you know, having to stir in a pot or take care of a kid's needs or whatever. So that's a difference. You know, you're not just doing one thing, just like your ground is not monoculture. You're not growing just one thing. You know, it's kind of similar. So we've sort of created this highly efficient way of being that's ultimately not that efficient because we are self-destructing in a way. You know, you can't just do one thing all day long. So, but it's once your eyes are open, it's possible to modify, you know, like sitting behind a computer, it's not that hard to learn to get up and move once in a while. You don't have to do it frenetically. You know, this whole notion about the best position is the next position is, I think, very warped. You know, it's a kind of message that everything is so dreadful that you have to constantly be escaping it in a frenetic way. You know, you can't. No, I think if you sit well, it's perfectly healthy to sit for an extended period, not all day, every day. But certainly you don't have to be constantly moving around. However, if all you know is poor positions, then it's much better to keep switching them out. It's much better to do many bad positions than just be stuck in one of them. Then the cumulative damage becomes very high.
There's an element here of awareness or mindfulness that you're talking about. Like, so instead of trying to find like the right posture, like somebody would have told us and tried to put ourselves in a position, is it more like being in the body and being in a relationship with gravity in the body and becoming kinesthetically aware of that? So the chair below us, the gravity around us, our body within, and to consider all the environmental factors.
You know, in a traditional context, people aren't following rules by any means, you know, and they're constantly adapting to the constantly changing forces on us as we move around. You know, there isn't any set of rules that's going to be detailed enough to know exactly what to do with every body part as you lean over and do this and do that. That said, you know, when you're teaching a beginner how to be differently in their body, it's a lot like learning a language. And it does help to break things down and to have an intellectual vantage point, as well as a visual one, as well as a kinesthetic one. Like with learning a language, a really good way, I think, is to zoom in and zoom out. Sometimes you zoom in on a point of grammar or a spelling convention, and it's very detailed. It's very intellectual. Sometimes you zoom out and you're memorizing a poem and you have no idea what half the words mean, but you're learning different things. You're learning the cadence. You're learning grammatical structures, the flow of the language, and so on. So we use lots of different ways to help people learn. And I think that's the reason we are so efficient and effective. Yeah, we really have focused on that.
Okay, so can we go back to your first back surgery and then coming out and trying to solve this problem? So other than remembering what your mom had said in your youth, I think you traveled and spent time with different groups.
Yeah, yeah.
Was this during that time?
First, I studied with teachers, like I said, the approaches that made sense. So in particular, Noel Perez's teachers in Paris. And so I really immersed myself in her work and got a lot from there. And then traveled and dug into the medical literature. And I had my natural lab, in that I had acupuncture patients, almost every one of which has back problems. Almost all modern people have back problems, in fact, you know. So it was a very fertile kind of ecosystem for me to train my methods, to see what works, What needs to, what has danger of flaring up, and so on. So, some of the most important shifts that we teach, we admonish people to not begin there, that there are some prerequisites, just like when you're preparing a pottery, if you're doing pottery, you don't begin by resculpting. You first prepare the clay, you massage the clay. And so there are equivalents in the human body. You don't start by just sticking your bum back, which is one of the things that results from the other things we do, from having a toned set of glutes, from having relaxed abdominal, rectus abdominis muscles, and so on. So, we arrive at results in a very carefully considered way.
Yeah, wonderful. So you studied Alexander technique. Was this part of
Just a little bit,
just a little
just a
bit?
little bit. Yeah. I really respect Alexander technique. I think he was incredibly intuitive, and he used biofeedback on himself, basically looking in a mirror and seeing what it is that was happening that made him lose his voice. So he observed these micro tensions and was able to train himself out of them. And I think that's why Alexander technique has such a strength in the neck and shoulder area. Yeah. I don't think he fully gelled or articulated the importance of the pelvic position. I think that comes sort of as a result. And in our methodology, it's actually left, right, and center. We treat it like a foundation. And yes, we pay separate and special attention to the neck and the feet and the shoulders and every part of our musculoskeletal system. But the pelvis really has a very special place in the Gokhale method, kind of like a foundation. The feet are also like a foundation. And the neck kind of rides, like Alexander said, free and easy, on the rest of the platform. But we go back and forth and back and forth between all our parts. But I think Alexander technique really puts primacy on the neck and head. And given the history, the fact that Alexander used to lose his voice and was an actor, it makes sense. And so that's one of the things I really like, the richness in that, and that it's subtle, it's nuanced. The thing I like about our approach that's different is that we use all these different channels. We use not just kinesthetic channels, which is mainly what Alexander Technique's teachers use, from what I've experienced and observed. There's a lot of hands-on, and there's a lot of repetition, and the student feels wonderful, and they go home and they're not quite sure what happened. Like they don't know how to articulate it intellectually or visually. And so that's a strength that we have, is that you it it l you it looks right, it feels right, and it makes sense. And you have all these different grids that or vantage points that you're using. So if you have strength in one over the other, not it everybody it holds everybody. It provides a net for everybody, either they're going to be visual or intellectual or auditory or kinesthetic, and there are cues and very well defined pathways in each of these channels. So you don't get lost if you've like it felt good and now you don't have an idea how to ha get the handle back on it. In our ways, you have other, in our methodology, you have several different ways of coming to that place or So that's one of the things I like, and it also makes it very efficient because, you know, we don't keep our students so very long. You know, our courses are sometimes just a weekend, and it's just a few hours of training, which I think is unique because most methods of this nature go for years. The period of training is expected to be years, not days or weeks. And so we've given ourselves a rather short runway to impart. And so that's it has to be very textured and multifaceted if we're going to succeed. Now, what we've discovered over the years is that humans do learn best by repetition and drill, and that they do forget. You know, we have a forgetting curve just like we have a learning curve. And so we now keep our students past their initial courses, but we keep them in exercise programs where they get reminded of these principles that they've learned, but they're also getting exercise, either yoga or fitness or dance or tai chi. And so that turns out to be a really rich, sustainable way for them to get the repetition that they need, but also while they're at it, get exercise that everybody needs. And, you know, we tend to sort of weave a lot of things into these offerings. There's art and there's community and there's technology and there's a cultural immersion, and, you know, just to make it interesting, more sustainable, more fun, and event and effect land better in the end. Yeah.
Since you brought up the pelvis, so in as a martial artist, that's of high importance to us. So in the Chinese texts, we have the Dan Tian, like they're constantly saying this is the key thing. So you're familiar with this. So could you talk a little bit? So.
Yeah, you know, my background before I went into posture was in Chinese medicine, as I said, right? So, yes, I'm very familiar with these points. Dan Tian is in Chinese, it's Qi Hai, Sea of Qi. And the corresponding point in the back is Shen Men. So, it's the kidney correspondence point. And you want to keep those open. It's like a pilot burner. And the way a lot of modern posture is, the sit up straight kind of posture basically squishes the kidney correspondence point and you know, the governing vessel in the back. And the way when we tuck our pelvis, which is a very common modern guideline, especially if you have a swayed back, that's kind of a given. And then that will squish Qi Hai, right? Or the Dan Tian. It also doesn't give the pelvic organs enough room to function, nor the right orientation. It messes with the blood supply and the nerve supply to the pelvic organs. And it does a lot of mischief. And so, yeah. Pelvis, very important, and you can see it in different ways. You can see, you know, it in Chinese medicine ways, but, you know, most people don't particularly want to subscribe to the whole philosophy of Chinese medicine. So I usually present the rationale in anatomic terms. You know, it's like, this is what you see in the populations we're emulating because they're highly functional, because they're pain-free, because they have a long tradition of the body beautiful. I'm thinking the Greek athletes, you know, or and we can learn from them. And so we copy what they're doing. And then secondarily to that, I present the anatomic arguments, the what's happening with the nerves and the arteries and the veins and the lymph drainage, and you know, so it becomes pretty compelling in multiple ways.
So what is the your suggestion for the pelvis and lower back? So what's the instruction there?
Yeah, so I coined the phrase J spine to distinguish it from an S spine. And so it's a calligraphy kind of J, a stylized J, if you will. And the very lowest portion of the J is, it's not like a hook that comes up, it's the sacrum basically that angles back. So it's where the bottom meets the back is where you want a pronounced angle. And then up higher, where conventional wisdom has it, you should have a lumbar curve that needs a lumbar pillow and lumbar support that you find in all every ergonomic chair, except ours. It's like, no, we want that flat. So our, you know, we haven't created many products at all. We have less than half a dozen, but a chair and a cushion are in there. And what their function is to reduce the lumbar curve, not support and exacerbate it. So the bottom, yes, the bottom wants to be out behind, but we use a cushion with little sticky nubs for the mid back to hook to. Yeah, we teach people to elongate their back and then hook themselves to the cushion or the nubbies on our that are sewn into the backrest of our chair so that they're kind of stuck. Part of their weight is hanging from the backrest and they're in traction in the lower in the lumbar spine. Yeah, instead of letting a whole bunch of weight kind of squish the bottom of the heap. You know, L4, L5 is the most commonly damaged disc. L5, S1 is the second most commonly damaged disc. Those two are at the bottom of the heap. And it really behooves us to offload those discs if we've been superloading them and they're degenerated and in trouble and the nerve roots are pinched and people are suffering from sciatic pain and stenosis and what have you. So our first measure is to actually elongate the lumbar spine. Whether the person comes in with a C spine because they've been tucking their pelvis and being relaxed and slumped, or they have a sway in their back because they've been trying to compensate for that C spine and they've been arching their back. Either way, you know, the upper lumbar spine, whether it's curved forward in a C or arched back in an S, our first measure is to stretch that part of the spine out, flatten it, lengthen it, create a little more space for the discs between those vertebrae, create more room for the exiting nerve roots. And right there, people usually experience a lot of relief. That's how we start. And then we talk about the behind and the pelvis. So that's a later step for us, even when it is often the most important step.
Yeah. So that's wonderful. So when we're now, if we're not sitting and we're walking or we're in activity, how do
Yeah.
we maintain that? 'Cause I know you have like corset breathing and these different things, like in your views on belly breathing, if you could share.
So, you know, I like to start people with this traction idea to create length because it's relatively easy. We teach them to do it up against a backrest, and we teach them to do it in a bed where you don't even need any equipment. And so those are low-hanging, juicy fruit. So that's a good reason to start there. But obviously, people can't be up against a backrest and lying in a bed all day. So when they come out, like you said, they're walking around now. How do they maintain? So that is now they have to learn how to recruit their deeper abdominal muscles and their deep back muscles to maintain that length and brace themselves and such. So, and the getting the behind, you sustain that and even create it by the way you walk. So that's a very, very important chapter in our approach. We build to it in our beginning courses. And after we've created length and we can sustain that length in the back, and we've done all kinds of little tweaks all over the body. Walking becomes a way of doing a lot of shifting in the pelvis, you know, by toning the glutes. Every step is a rep, the way we teach it. And, you know, then if you've got toned glutes, then they help to hold the behind. So it's not just a way of sustaining this structure, it's also a way of creating it. But people first have to go through some prerequisites, like I say, preparing the clay and, you know, keeping the upper lumbar spine taller, sturdier, and so on. That comes ahead of getting the pelvis in a good position.
Yeah. I'm struck by, so back to Alexander, I have a lot of my background comes from him. So he starts off with this idea of inhibition, where if like, if you're doing the wrong thing that's causing you problems, you have to recognize that before you can start doing the right thing.
You know, I teach people, you don't want to use the brakes and the accelerator at the same time. But in some cases, you actually do, because, you know, the brakes are doing so much damage that you counter them with some accelerator anyway. And then you learn to, you know, let go of the brakes and you ramp up on your ability to use the accelerator and so on. That is, for example, it is something we do in the upper lumbar area. Yeah. Because people have this arching going on, and that really does quite a lot of damage, you know, can cause stenosis, can cause all kinds of, you know, sciatic pain, nerve impingement. So that is a huge cost to pay. So no, we want to learn how to use these deeper abdominal muscles to counter that even before the person really can come in touch with those tensions and relax and release them. We do a patch job, actually, first. Now, we don't do that in the neck. In the neck, it's much more delicate. And that, as I observed earlier, was Alexander's, you know, strength and stronghold, really. And so I don't find that a good... So, for example, conventional wisdom has you push on the chin back. And I teach people to not do that. I teach them to first relax and release in the back of the neck and only then develop the longus calli strength and so on that'll help push up against a weight that you're carrying on your head, for example. You know, so different approaches for different parts, whatever works. I'm not driven by theory, by abstraction, by sort of universal principles that have to hold no matter what. I'm very pragmatic. So as I said, our driving goal has been effective, efficient, you know, and that means a whole lot of different things for different parts, different things for different people. And we try to really make every piece land in multiple ways. You know, it's like you're taking a stride. There's a big agenda. There are like a dozen things that need to happen with every stride. You're strengthening your glutes. You're lengthening your psoas. You're strengthening your calves. You're lengthening your calves. You're squeezing your feet muscles with every step. You're doing all kinds of things, you know. And that's the only thing that actually makes sense, because we don't have all day every day to do one exercise for every little part that is weak or tight. You know, that doesn't add up. That's like a full-time job really quickly if you've got several things aching. Yeah.
In the walking that you just described, psoas, glutes, feet, is the person visualizing all this? Or are they feeling all this? Like, what's the methodology you're using?
Different ways at different points in their trajectory, you know? Like, we use intellectual, logical explanations a lot at the outset, because most people who come to see us, and modern society in general, is rather intellectually cued, right? We're carrying a huge amount of gray matter around all day. Why not use it? Yeah. And so I often begin there because it just packs a punch. And then people have the comfort, the lifeline of understanding what they're doing. And then we graduate them to other ways of approaching. You know, there's a certain look and a certain feel, and there's emotion that goes with some of these things, and there's communion with nature, and there's all kinds of ways, and there's art, you know, like we can look at a photograph of our, you know, our great great grandparent, and it's staring at you between the eyes, you know, and it's like, wow, that's my genetic stock, and look at that, where and how come I came out this way, you know, that's very stark, right? That creates quite a deep realization of even an indignation. Sometimes I like to almost encourage that, you know, not, you don't want to stay stuck with indignation, but you know, we really did get shortchanged in modern culture around how to be in our bodies, and we suffer greatly and unnecessarily, I think.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So can we talk about belly breathing a little bit? So coming from maybe your yoga and different practices, we're really encouraged to do belly breathing.
Totally. Some meditation subcultures, yoga subcultures is where you find this a lot. And I think it's a very useful skill to be able to belly breathe. And there are certain contexts in which you really need it. For example, if you are a singer or a saxophone player, you know, the diaphragm is the muscle you have most precise control over. But I don't buy at all that it is the right default kind of breathing. And I actually think, you know, when you examine which subcultures it kind of took root in, it's yoga, meditation primarily. And I actually think I have a conjecture. It's a little out there. So I'm not going to put a ton of stock in it, but here's my theory, and you can see if it makes any sense to you or not. Have a little statue of the earliest Chinese Buddha figure that I show students, you know, when there's some distance along in their studies. And he's a really slumped Buddha figure. He looks as slumped as any modern, you know, computer worker does. He's got a kind of poochy belly and a completely vertical sternum and sunken chest, and his head is forward, his shoulders are forward. It's like, wow, totally different from the Buddha figures that we see in South Asia and Southeast Asia. And so my conjecture is that, you know, meditation, Buddhist meditation in particular, came from warm countries where people are adept at sitting on the floor cross-legged all their lives. I mean, in my company, we have a software developer in India, and all his meals has ate are eaten cross-legged on the floor with no support at all, and he does it marvelously, you know, like a baby does, and like people in these kind of cultures do into adulthood. But then when Bodhidharma went to China, that was a cold country, and people are not used to sitting cross-legged on the floor in cold countries. They have furniture. The Chinese are famous for their furniture styles through the ages. You have Ming Dynasty furniture and Song Dynasty furniture and so on. And I'm wondering whether, in the way people like to emulate their leaders, their spiritual teachers, whole hog, right? You know, not really kind of dissecting for what parts make sense in their lives and perhaps what pieces may be better adapted. Right? That's not the way the tradition goes. It's like you follow, you subjugate your ego, and you know, you just do everything the same way and don't question. That's in many traditions. And if that would have been the case here, then they would just follow those Indian teachers and try to sit cross-legged, and that's how they would have then looked, because they won't have the structure, the hip structure, the ankle structure. You know, these are not people who are who have been sitting cross-legged on the ground. So that's how the Chinese early followers would have come out. And then, if that's the way you're sitting, then you're not going to be able to chest breathe very well. And the only way you're going to get enough oxygen in there is by belly breathing. And then that actually selects for a weak abdomen. And I see a lot of belly breathers with very poochy abdomens, very sunken chests. And that's adaptive, because if you're only allowing yourself to breathe from your abdomen, you better keep your abdominal wall weak. Otherwise, you are not going to get enough air. And so I see this. So I think that's a kind of spiral of dysfunction, of misunderstanding, you know, like copying form without understanding the function and the principles. And so I really think that was a bad turn we took, this belly breathing and and a lack of chest breathing. Chest breathing is what allows your rib cage to be a healthy shape and size and structure. You need that healthy stress on the bones as you're growing, you know, otherwise it's just going to be the shape and size it was when you last belly, you know, chest breathe at 5 years old or whatever. Not so healthy. So anyway, that's a lot of song and dance. I'm not going to sign my name to it.
No, but it's interesting because I do I've seen this too from teaching in my own practices, where a lot of belly breathing, I see larger lordotic curves as a way to support the body, and like you said, the chest is not moving, and there's the dependence on the lower back, which you would need if you're constantly trying to breathe in and out the belly, and it does this weird shape. And in certain practices, like yoga, it's like that's not a functional practice. We're just sitting. We're not running and moving and jumping. Where like a basketball player or somebody like this would have to have a strong core or a sprinter.
Totally. What I focus on is what's happening all day, every day. You know,
Right.
it's like what's happening in the 23 hours that you're not doing yoga or some practice. And, you know, what does normal look like then?
Yeah.
And I think you need movement in the back, you need movement in the chest, and you don't need movement in the belly as much, except in special contexts. And yeah.
So then, are we, how do I want to ask you this question? So you're contracting in the stomach. You wouldn't want to seem like you were like holding, because that's sometimes like going to be like you'll see that. So there's a more natural way to achieve this. I don't want to say strong core. You hear all this kind of misinformation, like they're kind of moving at what you're saying, but I feel like you've done it so eloquently.
You know, I don't use the word core at all, because I don't want to entertain quarrels with people who are using that word to mean things that I wouldn't include as part of what wants to contract to support the spine. So, for example, you know, rectus abdominis, the six-pack muscle, tends to get very overemphasized in most abdominal workouts, right? If we think about what's the most popular thing that people do if they want to strengthen their core, it's crunches. It used to be sit-ups, which thank goodness have been retired. And crunches are on their way out. You now see articles in the New York Times Wellness blog and, you know, places with high readership. And the Canadian Army has thrown out crunches. And the US Army, if you have a back problem, you're not allowed to do crunches. So it's under fire, but it's still in the lay population the most common ab workout that people do. And so I don't like to, instead of specifying that, oh, my version of core doesn't have so much rectus abdominis, I have rather used a completely different terminology. So there's no quarreling. You know, I use inner corset, which then visually it preserves the basic shape. It leaves your behind behind. It doesn't suddenly tuck your pelvis as you're trying to strengthen your upper lumbar area. So you keep the shape, you make yourself sleeker and therefore taller. The stuff has to go someplace. And now you're much better protected. And yeah, so that's something you do, and you need extra protection because there's something threatening the spine. But increasingly, and especially since COVID, I'm seeing people show up as being extremely weak in their abdominal muscles. And even, if you have good alignment and good structure, but really weak abdominal muscles, it still doesn't work so well. You kind of collapsed into yourself. So I have started encouraging people to do a little bit of what I call the inner corset all the time, 10 or 20% of what's possible, just to make up for the lack of tone that I'm seeing increasingly in people.
It sounds like also when you're teaching, your method is working. So you talk about parts, but you're really talking about the whole system.
Always. It's so much more efficient, right? It doesn't take any longer to cover all bases than to zero in on one piece, which, okay, then you strengthen the muscles around this one joint, which has been the one giving trouble. And now what about the one upstream and the one downstream? That's coming next. And if you haven't polished the way the person is walking, bending, etc., something else will give. And why wait for one piece to fall apart at a time and treat it piecemeal? So I rather zoom out and cover all bases. And then people have multiple benefits and they're preventing all kinds of things they don't even need to know about. And it's more satisfying.
Your work, I think, I'm going to say predates a little bit the modern sort of fascia research that's picked up a lot in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, people have all kinds of adhesions and stuck places, and from their legs being kinked and from using their muscles in the wrong cascade of contractions and so on. So, yeah, what I always like to go back to is anthropological and historical basis for what I'm doing. And then theory comes next. But I love theory, I'm a scientist and I love understanding why something makes sense. But I also have the experience that you can really talk yourself into a wrong direction. It sounds right, but it just isn't. Things like parallel feet, it seems reasonable, but I don't think it's right. But a lot of modern alternative types, do that. And then I've had people tell me, well, if you were driving a car, you wouldn't want the wheels to be pointing out. It's like, yes, but it's a little different in a human being. So I think abstraction comes second. And observing, I don't think we know enough about the human structure to begin solving the engineering problem that we are. I think that should take a humble second seat to observation, mimicking highly functional people, which thank goodness still exist, although they're becoming harder and harder to find. And we still have photographs, sculptures, and so on. So we still have clues that abound and we can find our way home. We're doing it all the time with great success. And yeah, so one of the things that's been very encouraging lately is that Stanford has taken an interest in this method and is now running a randomized controlled trial comparing Gokhale method with physical therapy for lower back pain. So that's very, very encouraging because for years we wanted, we wished for a credible researcher to take interest in this because we see all kinds of things which sort of border on the miraculous happening, but that doesn't count for much. That's just anecdotal evidence. But now we have something really exciting on the horizon to really check to what extent our methodology is actually a solution for this number one cause of global disability, that is back pain.
Well, congratulations. I'm excited. I'll look for that.
Thank
study.
You.
So with the feet, do you recommend barefoot?
It's a complicated story. It depends on the person. It depends on how debilitated they are, how much they know about how to use their feet, what kind of surface they're walking on, how much bandwidth they have available to put into practice, what they know about what to do. So it depends. So on the one end of the spectrum, you're a hunter-gatherer and you have all the kinesthetic wisdom. It's like, yeah, sure, go barefoot. On the other end of the spectrum, you have someone who's got plantar fasciitis, bunions, not much musculature in the foot. And no, we want this person to have a structured shoe with insoles and then teach them. But always teach the person what, even the hunter-gatherer, we like to teach them what they're doing right. So they won't lose it in a, you know, like joining a random exercise class where people are encouraged to do this, that, and the other random stuff, like, you know, lift your heart and arch your back and tuck your pelvis. And, you know, even people who show up with really good structure are a little bit vulnerable in our modern mindset. Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you would like to add?
No, it felt very comprehensive. Thank you for doing this. It was a pleasure.
No, thank you. I really appreciate it.
So, yeah, if people are interested, the best way for them to proceed is to attend one of our free online workshops. We have a couple every week, and they should just go to our website, goklemethod.com. And gokle is spelled funny, G-O-K-H-A-L-E, method.com. Although if they look up Esther posture, they're likely to find their way to us as well. And then that's a good starting point. And then we have all kinds of free services and initial consultations and online teaching and in-person teaching. We have teachers all around the world, so they can go from there.
Okay. And I'll put your contacts in the show notes as well.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
Yes, it was a pleasure meeting you.
Likewise.